Hello and welcome to Taking Care of Business. I'm Jackie Mitchell. This is where we pick the best brains in the business world, and you, the listener, feel like you are eavesdropping on a really interesting coffee conversation to give you and your business the inside edge. We take a look into the minds and brands of successful leaders and probe into how they think, feel, learn, manage teams and themselves. This show is about connecting and creating conversations that matter, building your powers of influence, persuasion, and ultimately communication. We explore the latest evidence-based findings in neuromarketing, consumer behavior, business techniques, tips, trends, and tricks. We love sharing the knowledge and serve brain food to keep your business healthy. To continue eavesdropping and to connect with me, you can find me on LinkedIn, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and my website, brandstorm.com.au. So while our first guest settles in, orders their coffee, grab yourself one, and we'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Taking Care of Business. Our first guest is an expert in leadership and team performance. She is an author of, and this is her second book, called The Dynamic Leader, and I have great pleasure in giving a very warm welcome to Shelley Flett. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, Shelley. Good to have you here. Now, your second book, what was the first book?
So the first book was The Direction Dilemma, Why Knowing What You Want Makes You a Better Leader.
Right, and then that was a natural progression to book number two, The Dynamic Leader.
The Dynamic Leader, yes, I get the titles mixed up a little bit.
Yeah, I can see why. So what's the main difference between the two books?
So the first book looks at having a vision or having a goal in the future that you then make decisions in order to head in that particular direction, whereas the dynamic leader is more around this is how I lead a team of people. So it probably goes from self to then leadership
right.
as a progression.
And so what led you down this path? How did it all happen?
How did I become an author?
Yeah, well, what sort of motivated you or inspired you to write a book about this area?
So I've been running a leadership program for probably the last 3.5 years, and through every program that I ran, I felt like I needed to go deeper into detail. But, of course, with only one day, I didn't have a way to do that. So the book was really created out of running the program so many times and just having a lot more depth of the topics and things that I was talking about. So the book came really naturally as part of the feed-off of the one-day program.
Right. Yeah, I'm always curious as to why people write a book as to their motivation. You know, some use it as a business card on steroids, some use it for their brand, and that's an interesting one that you've said you've actually wanted a platform to be able to delve a little bit deeper beyond the one-day sort of bite-sized learning into something with a bit more meat on the bone, so to speak.
Yeah.
So was there any point that you've thought, I'm going to sort of make some money out of the sales of this book?
No, even now people ask me, you know, how many books have you sold? And it's really not front of mind. What I want is for leaders out there to get value out of it, to be able to actually take it and implement it. So
right.
I'd love to be able to say, this is how many leaders have gone and, you know, applied different things from my book, and this is what it enabled them to do and enabled them to be as leaders.
Yeah.
That's where my passion is.
Great. Yes, I can hear the passion. So team performance specialist, is that how you introduce yourself? So if someone meets you at a barbecue and asks you what you do for a job, what do you say?
Yeah, so leadership and team performance is definitely the two words that come together when I'm introducing myself.
Mm.
And I think you need both. I think you need leadership for team performance, and I think you need team performance for effective leadership. So they sort of come hand in hand.
Yeah. So what was your background? How did you end up here or at the moment? I mean, things can happen in the future, but where you are right now, what was the training and background that you had?
So I actually worked in banking in an operational capacity for 10 years prior to starting my own business and going out on my own. And the real drive for me was when I first became a leader, I was sort of thrown into leadership and didn't get a great deal of direction. I had a lot of advice. In hindsight, it was well-meaning, bad advice. Mm. So, the intention was really great with the leaders that were giving it, but it didn't suit me and my personality and ended up getting me in a lot of trouble. And so I kind of buried myself in a hole, and it took 3 years to dig myself out and to figure out, how do you actually lead a team? How do you deliver results as well as be nice to people and create a good culture without, burning out or spontaneously combusting, which I think a lot of leaders sort of feel the pressure and the stress of.
Right. So from your own experience, you said that you sort of fell into a hole. It took you 3 years to get out of it. Is that right? Did I hear that right?
Yeah.
So how did you get out of it? What were some of the tools that you used besides a shovel, the metaphorical shovel, to get out of that hole?
Needed a backhoe.
Yeah.
So I think wallowing in self-pity. So I think that was a really important part for me. I was really angry and wanted to blame other people to start with. And then I had probably had some really good role models in my life, including my older sister, who the book is dedicated to, who said, pull your head in. There's things that you can do. There's a lesson to be learned here. And it wasn't until I decided that I was going to make a lesson out of it, as opposed to being a victim because of it, that I was able to move forward. And then I was just in search of anything and everything that I could improve my self-awareness. I studied neuro-linguistic programming. I did as many sort of courses and got coaching and mentoring as I could. It was progressive. I was surrounded by a really good group of people who were there to support me, but those that wouldn't tell me what I wanted to hear, but what I needed to hear. So a bit of tough love, I think.
Yeah, that's wonderful. It's great that you're able to tell your story and share it, because I think it's a lot more common than people actually realise, because most people are not confident or comfortable enough to share that or courageous enough to share it. So it's wonderful that you can share that. Now, during that time, you mentioned your older sister was a role model. Where else did you get inspiration? Was there any, like, was it an Oprah moment, or was there a particular quote, or was there an author or some other inspiration that helped you move forward?
There were so many. I think I started watching TED Talks, and one that really stands out as being as having a huge impact was Brené Brown and her the power of vulnerability, mm-hmm. and how she talked about standing in the arena and embracing the courage, like having the courage to push on and do it even though it hurts and is uncomfortable. And I think, because one of the things that I automatically wanted to do was just shut down my emotions and put a shell around me to protect myself, whereas what I needed to do is walk head on into the relationship, emotional, people side of things, and Brené Brown was a huge source of inspiration in that respect.
Yeah, I think you've picked a good one there. I think it's one of the most, if not the most, watched TED Talks there are. And she's got a show on Netflix. Have you seen that?
I have. I actually saw her live. She came to Australia about, I think it was probably 8 years ago, and spoke to Business Chicks. And I was at that event, and what she speaks about on Netflix was what she spoke about then. So I love it. I love the content. It's fabulous.
What a great experience. And now you've transferred all this, which I think is really key, that you've gone through this personal experience. So when you're then coaching people yourself and facilitating them to go through this change to be a dynamic leader, you can actually speak from first-hand experience, which I think gives it that little bit of extra power, bit of extra zoom, bit of extra zest to it. Now, as part of the book, you talk about your tried and tested 9-stage model. Now, I have to ask you, why are there 9 stages?
Well, I started with 3. So I started with relationships. So it's like you've got to get the relationships right as a leader, and then At the other end of the spectrum, you've got to deliver results. And so I sort of looked at those as being on two opposing ends of the spectrum. But the requirement for a leader was to really have a good balance, which is where I came up with the third one around inspiring respect. And so it's actually the third one, which is the middle one of the model, which looks at taking on different perspectives and being curious. And the one where I ask leaders just to sit with silence and to ask more than they tell and to listen more than they speak. And I pulled it together as three. And then when I went through each of the three components, relationships, respect and results, I found that there was a natural progression of, you know, what are we saying? And then what are we doing to actually back up what we're saying? So how are we walking the talk? How are we actually building credibility? And then the third layer of that was around who are we being? What's the culture that we're defining for our team? So it was a little bit of an evolutionary cycle. It started out as sort of three things and then just grew from there. But grew to a point where when I got to the nine, I was like, this is actually the fundamentals of leadership. And if you can get these nine things right, then you can adapt to everything else. You can just go with it.
Oh, I love it. It's really inspiring. Shelley Flett, congratulations, and I wish you continued success with your book, The Dynamic Leader. And if anyone listening wants to continue the conversation with you, they can find your website, shelleyflett.com. They can follow you on LinkedIn and Twitter.
Absolutely.
And your book is available, I'm assuming, wherever you buy books.
Yes, on my website or Dimmix or there's Amazon, lots of places.
Fantastic. Now, I just want to leave our listeners with something quite inspirational. Do you have a favourite quote or a favourite pearl of wisdom that sometimes when you find yourself in that little bit of hole, we all do that probably more often than we're prepared to admit, is there some phrase or something that helps you move forward?
Probably the biggest one is we're all doing the best we can with the resources we have, and be kind.
Be kind. What a nice way to finish off. Shelley Flett, thank you very much for your valuable time today.
Thanks, Jackie. Appreciate it.
Thank you. We like being kind here on Taking Care of Business as we pick the best brains in the business world to help you grow your business. And we'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Taking Care of Business. Our next guest is a keynote speaker and advisor on new ways of working. It's a real big theme at the moment. She helps businesses think and work in ways that are more productive, collaborative, creative and effective. Lots of ifs in there. She's the author of Ish, The Problem with Our Pursuit for Perfection and the Life-Changing Practice of Good Enough. And it was the title of that book that attracted me to talk to our next guest, because it is certainly a common thread about this pursuit of perfection and the downsides of it. So I'd like to welcome, please, Lynn Kazaley. Hello.
Hello. Hi, Jackie.
Hello. Really well, thank you. But before I start on this pursuit of for perfection, which was really attractive to me because it is a common thread, those listening would go, Lynn Kazaley, up there, Kazaley, is there a connection?
Yes, it's quite a famous name. I probably get asked that, you know, every day pretty much.
Yeah, well, that's right. It'd be like if your surname was Barassi. It's an unusual name in a way.
That's
so
right.
What's the connection with Up There Kazaley, the very famous song?
Yeah, the famous song, and the song is after the famous footballer Roy Kazaley. Mm-hmm. And so he played last century now. He played for like St Kilda and the Hawks and South Melbourne then, the Swans, and was also coach. And he's my great-great-uncle.
Oh,
so
wow.
You could work that out in your own family, you know. Think of your great-granddad's brother.
Yeah, right. Fantastic. Yeah. And so who do you follow now?
I sort of share my football love around. But I did grow up in the Moorabbin area, so that's where the Saints, you know, were drawing all their players from in the early days.
Right.
So I got pretty attached to them, I think.
Yeah, well, it's great to have that legacy and the heritage, particularly with it's a cool name. I mean, it's almost that the Hollywood producers would have given it to you if you didn't have it naturally.
It's a name to be proud of.
Yeah, well, definitely. I suppose, is it only in Victoria or do other people around Australia know of it?
Predominantly Victoria, but there's also some of the Kazali up in Cairns. You know, there's the stadium and there's the social club and the same in Darwin. So it's certainly spreading around. And I think Roy Kazali was sort of inducted into the Swans Hall of Fame. So now a lot more Sydney siders are across it too.
Oh, okay,
that's
great.
Yeah, I think it's still
crazy. Well, it's funny, my name being Mitchell, it's no connection with, but my dad actually played for Essendon, so there's a bit of a connection there, but of course no one ever asks me that because it's Mitchell, it's like Smith, you know? There you go, something in common. But let's talk about this drive for perfection, which there is a bit of a parallel there with elite sports people because they have this issue, but elite business people also have this issue, but not even elite, the average business person. It's so misguided. So what drew you to writing about this pursuit of perfection?
Well, I'm probably a reformed perfectionist now. I was going to say I'm a perfectionist. I was. And a combination of a couple of things. I did some work with some agile software development teams. So I started to see how they were willing to put software and apps and things out there into the public use, and they weren't finished. You know, they were just in early stages, but what they were able to do was test their initial work to see how well it was received. And I was like, hey, I like this idea. And then I also did some performance with Impro Melbourne some years ago. And so it's been a bit of a collision of both of these things, that you can make stuff up like improvisation and it's actually pretty good. And then in software development, you can put stuff out there and it's not fully formed or not fully finished and it's pretty good. So the idea of good enough and that we can go for good enough, go for somewhat, and that's what ish means, sort of near enough, good enough.
Near enough is good enough.
Many things.
Yeah, I really like that. So where does the line, look, I'm sure it's blurry, but maybe not. Maybe you've got it clear. But where is the line between excellence and high standards and perfection?
Well, all of these things are unknown to us until we do define them. So, you know, lots of industries work in ways where they have to reach particular standards. You know, you think of food handling and engineering and construction and healthcare. And so they have certain standards they have to reach. But when we're going for perfection, it's usually something that we conjure up in our mind. And so it's a mental image and we haven't actually defined what the standard is. And that's why going for perfection is so, you know, draining in a way, because we just keep going and going and going and there's no sign of when we're going to stop because we don't know what the standard is.
Oh, okay. So then we reach what we think is perfection. Then when we get there, we go, hang on, it's not perfect. Then you just keep going.
Yeah. So and then you don't feel good about it. And so there's this terrible trap or cycle of, I'm going for perfection. I can't get there. I still feel crap about it. So I must try harder next time. And so this cycle continues, and in fact it's better for us to say, you know what, forget perfect, just go for something that's functional and good enough and put it out there and test it, just like the software developers, see how it goes.
And then
work in iterations, let's see if we can improve it over time.
Now, in your book, you talked about you had some research. It was according to some further research, 41,000 subjects were researched by some PhD researchers, Thomas Curran and Andrew Hill, and they found that perfectionism is on the rise. Why?
Look, I think it's driven by, you know, our competitive world. You know, things are more, I won't say dramatic, but things can be a little bit more, there can be more pressure on us to do well. But I'm certain it's also the idea of social media, you know, and just access to the internet. So it's much easier for us, say, to gather lots more information. So perfectionists are also known as maximizers. They keep gathering information. They're not sort of satisfied. So it's quite easy to keep looking and keep searching and keep gathering information just, you know, on our mobile devices. But perfectionism also involves often comparison. So it's also quite easy to compare ourselves with others when you look at social media and think, oh, I'm not doing as well as I hoped I would or I expected to, and I'm not doing as well as them. So it happens. Perfectionism's happening anyway, but the world is kind of getting more competitive, and then you've got some of these social media and information pressures as well.
Yeah, so I know with Facebook they have a philosophy in their offices about failing quickly. And it's which is around that close enough is good enough, almost like to actually just say, come on, hurry up. If you're going to make a mistake, make it fast, just do it and then move on, which is some benefits to that. I can also see some downsides to it, but it's interesting that it's been driven by the tech sector that close enough is good enough. I think that's a really nice message. It's a shame that they're not great communicators, that it's not it's not getting out for enough. But
Well, that's one of the sectors that I've worked in. So I've been observing over a number of years how they do work. It might not be fail, but it's test early and test often, rather than fail fast, I think, because no perfectionist wants to fail. That word doesn't even come into their vocabulary. That's why they work so hard.
Yeah, right.
So if we look at it more as try testing things, put an experiment out there and see how it goes and get some valuable insights, then that can help you refine what you're working on.
Yeah, it's funny you said that, because I'm always a big fan of pilots and testing. But I find a resistance from entrepreneurs, startups, small business owners who have this sense that it's going to take too long. I haven't got time to do the testing. And they just want to go fly straight into it and try and it's a real challenge. Have you found that in your experience?
Yeah, I think there's that path of, I'm going to keep working on this until it's finished. And I think, well, what if it's a bit wrong? Or what if it's not? You know, what if it's incorrect at the moment? You're now not going to know until you've done a heap more of now wasteful work. So why don't you do a bit of work, what we call an increment of work, test it, get some feedback to see is this going to work? Do people like it? Has it got legs? You know, it could be the first version of a website, or it could be a book, or it could be a workshop or some consulting. And then once you've got some feedback on it, then you know you can keep you get that validation and I guess course correction. And the course correction's a lot smaller now and less wasteful than if you keep doing trying to go for higher and higher quality.
Great advice. Now, you mentioned in the book as well three dangers to be aware of, and the three main ways entrepreneurs let perfectionism hinder their efforts. What are those three ways?
Oh, gee, I didn't know it was going to be a quiz.
Oh, well, one was all talk. This is in your book.
Oh.
Does it remember? Do you remember? I'll put you on the spot now. I'm sorry,
yeah,
Lynn.
Let's put our guest on the spot and see if she remembers her content.
See if you remember your book.
And put another iteration out.
Yeah, yeah, you know what? I'll give you some prompts. The first one is all talk.
Yeah.
Does that ring bells?
Procrastinating, so you keep blabbing on about great ideas that you've got, but you don't actually ever put them into practice.
Yes, that would be, in my experience, number one, people not starting.
Yes.
Because they're procrastinating and stuffing around, and it's just like, come on. And that incremental start is really key, I think.
Exactly. Just start with a little something, a little slice of work.
Yeah, and then the other is the opposite, is not stopping, which you've already mentioned as well.
Yeah, so that's the perfectionism of not knowing when's the end of this task or activity or project. And I think lots of us have kind of, you know, embarked on a project, whether it's a bathroom renovation or it's some creative project for our kids, that we don't know where to stop and we just keep going and going and going because it's not yet reached that image that we had in our mind of perfect.
Yeah, so you mentioned the good old famous Pareto principle of the 80-20 rule.
Yeah.
So tell us what you mean by that, how to use it.
Yeah, so Vilfredo Pareto noticed in Italy that 80% of the land was owned by just 20% of people. So the same thing applies to work effort, that you only need to put a little bit of effort in, 20%, and you can get a massive 80% return on your effort. But that also means that you can probably be wasting 80% of your time because all it's delivering is a mere 20% of results. So choose the better value tasks, start working on them, and you only need to do about 20% effort and you'll get an incredible result.
Lynn, does perfectionism come in different flavours or is it just one size fits all?
Very different flavours. So there's perfectionism where we have high standards for ourselves, so self-oriented perfectionism. Mm. There's perfectionism where we think society holds high standards for us.
Yeah.
And then the third type is where we have high standards for others. And they're all on the rise, particularly that middle one where we think society expects more of us. And it's not true. You know, this is the fallacy that we're like slaving away thinking that higher standards and higher quality is expected of it. And it actually isn't. We can afford to relax the pressure and most of the time people don't notice.
Yeah, amazing. Relax the pressure. I like that. What a nice way to finish up. Lynn Cazaly, thank you very much for your valuable time today. Your book, Ish, The Problem with Our Pursuit for Perfection and the Life-Changing Practice of Good Enough. And I assume it's everywhere you can buy a book. You can get that.
And if it's not, ask for it.
Yeah, it's true. You can go to Lynn Cazaly, easy to spell, .com. And what's your favourite social media platform?
Look, I'm on all of them at the moment, but I'm probably a little bit more on LinkedIn at the moment.
Okay, well, you can link up with Lynn Cazaly on LinkedIn and find out more of her work. It's certainly a fascinating area. The fact that it's on the rise, Lynn, it shows that... reading your book will put, if you know a perfectionist, buy them Lynn's book. Give them
that. Yeah, that's a great
birthday.
Idea.
Yeah.
So if you get given a few copies, you know, hint, hint.
I like it very much. Lynn Cazaly, always a delight. Thank you. We wish you continued success up there,
Thank
Lynn
you.
Cazaly. And we look forward to our next encounter. Thank you so much for sharing your knowledge, insights right here on Taking Care of Business. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Taking Care of Business. Our next guest is a sought-after coach, speaker, and strength psychology expert. I want to find out more. I'd like to welcome you, Dan Shee. Welcome.
Thank you, Jackie. Thank you for having me on the show.
Good to have you, Dan. Now, what's a strength psychology expert? I hadn't heard that term before. Could you tell me what it is?
Sure. Strength psychology is a part of positive psychology, and that's
okay.
a whole new, another terminology as well. Essentially, it's based on the foundation. All of us are born with certain gifts, natural strengths we all have in us. Often, we are not aware of that. If we are not aware of them, you know, you might not manage your work effectively. You might choose your wrong profession, and you often hear people saying, oh, somehow I feel dissatisfied, somehow I feel like my potential is not reached. But often what that meant is that they're not sure of their gifts and they're not using them properly.
Right, okay. Now, I did notice here in your bio, it says here, so you won't mind me mentioning it, but you hit rock bottom in 2008 while working as an executive for a Fortune 100 company, and you were compelled to search for more meaningful ways to work and live. Now, when you hit rock bottom, how did you know you hit rock bottom? What were some of the signs?
I remember so clearly. I have always been one of these people since a child. I just full of energy, very ambitious, highly driven, go, 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 you know, so never stop. I'm always very hopeful. And back around 2007, 2008, and I was a very successful executive, like you pointed out, for a global technology company. I became a mom already. I had two beautiful kids. I had everything from the outside. And I just remember, I just got to this stage, I was so tired, and I was miserable, and I was flat in terms of my energy, and I lost all my drive. So I still turn up to work like on autopilot. I can still capably do my job, but I just remember my drive's gone. And to me, it was quite a rock bottom, and then on top of that, while I was struggling with how I felt, I didn't have any tools and I didn't understand what was happening with me. So I just kept kept turning up, trying to be strong. And eventually, I think my body just cannot lie. I was so stressed with how I feel physically and mentally. I eventually collapsed in a taxi after another day of business meeting. Mm. And I was taken to the emergency operation 36 hours later. Apparently, I had already contracted a life-threatening illness inside of my body, and I wasn't even aware of it. And, you know, my kids at the time was only 3-year-old and 9-year-old. And what made me really sad at the time was my doctor told me it was completely caused by my stress. So meaning it was avoidable. So that was definitely the rock bottom in my life.
So how did you turn that around? So obviously you had to recover from a medical perspective, but what did you do mentally to rebuild and get back to where you wanted to be?
After I recovered myself, I think one thing is, before that wake-up call, so I always call my emergency operation as a wake-up call. Before that, you know what, Jackie, I was always hoping for a radical change, because I was thinking, maybe it's my job, you know, maybe it's where I live. So I was always looking for like external change that would make me happier. So while I was struggling how I felt, it wasn't like I wasn't thinking about solutions. So I spent a lot of time, you know, in daydreaming, could say that. So when the operation happened, when I realized life can be snapped out of you just like that in a split second, I was very determined that even before, you know, I got wheeled into the operation room, if I came out of this alive, I made a promise with myself. I was determined to find out how I can live my everyday in the best way possible. And rather than waiting for a magic solution to change everything around me, I was very determined to find out a way that how I can live better every day from just that day onwards. And I think that mindset changed me. I instantly jumped into research. I did extensive research over the years. I even enrolled myself to a Master of Coaching Psychology degree while I was still doing my C-level executive role. And the relief I found from my research was what I felt was normal, and it can be it can be changed. So I would say the knowledge really helped me to start changing my mindset. It's possible, and I can change from today.
So it's 11 years since that time, and you've now written your first book called Come Alive, Live a Life with More Meaning and Joy. So it's taken you, well, let's say 11, let's say 10 years to get to this point. How come you're writing a book now?
The change actually happened much quicker than I thought. You know how I talked to you about I went to do my coaching psychology degree. Mm. I learned so much about human behavior and how our human perform very quickly, and I started to apply a lot of tools. And one of the tools is you mentioned around strength psychology. I realized how I was working was wrong. I was doing, you know, I was not tapping into my own natural ability, my natural gifts. I was trying to be a perfectionist, always hoping to improve myself based on the weakness, you know, and there was a lot of things like pushing myself every day and not asking for help. And so by using tools like strength psychology, so by tapping into my my natural ability and not worrying too much about my weaknesses, by changing how I work every day in terms of my habits and everything, I was actually able to do the exactly same job. I didn't change my job. It was the exactly same job, just in a different company. I was able to turn up my work and feeling motivated, energized, and had loads of time for my family and myself. So I saw the change within roughly 6 months. I started to teach my team, and I started to help other people inside of my company and even in the industry. I started to voluntarily mentor and coach other people. But I remained in corporate, and I think that's the message I'm trying to say here. I didn't make a radical change, but I changed because of the habits I have reestablished for myself. And the reason taking me so long to write a book was really because I only left corporate 3 years ago, 2.5 years ago, actually. So, now I do what I do full-time as a coach, speaker, And so now I have the time to actually write down all the learning I have gathered in the last 10 years. Also because now I have worked with hundreds of people in my coaching practice, I feel like it's just not me talking, and I actually have a lot of, you know, evidence. I get to share the learning I can share with people.
You mentioned in the book it's about making the choice and giving yourself permission to be happy now, and I got stuck on that word permission. How important is it to give yourself permission to be happy?
You know, that's such a great question, Jackie, and I'm so glad you pick it up. One of the wake-up moments for me was when I was, you know, you can call that the pursuit of happiness and fulfillment journey I was taking on for a very long time, is I realized it was because I didn't give myself the permission to be happy, because so many of us, especially the high achievers, we were brought up believing success and achievement will give you happiness. So we did not understand. Actually, these are the things can be a result of your hard work, but has very little association with how you actually feel at a day-to-day basis. But because we're under assumption, only if you have achieved all of these things, then you can be happy. We are not allowing ourselves to be happy. We are fearful that might make us less driven, might make us complacent. But once you realize you can actually be happy right now with what you have already achieved, it starts to give you so much more energy and so much more less pressure. You can actually perform far better than you're under extreme, you know, dissatisfaction, discontent, and the constant pressure you put onto yourself. So I would say that is very, very important. In the work I do with my clients, often that is one of the first things I get them to think about. When is the last time you give yourself permission to go, you know what, I can be happy. I'm allowed to be happy.
Yeah, I think that element of permission is a real key to unlock so much good stuff. It's a great read. Come alive, live a life with more meaning and joy. You, Dan, thank you for sharing your story. That takes a lot of courage to do that, and I think that helps an enormous amount of people. I think it's an area that people don't talk openly enough about. I think they feel ashamed, or they feel a failure or embarrassed or whatever it is that's holding them back. And with people like yourself talking about your experiences and then offering to help people work their way through that and helping drive to give them permission to be happy, it's a wonderful purpose in life. And I really appreciate you spending some time with us today.
Thank you, Becky. I really appreciate you giving me the opportunity to share this message. And I must say that was the main purpose of me writing and share the story, is I want people to feel absolutely okay to not to feel okay at the time, and know that is not a unique problem. And by talking about it, by learning from what other people have done, you know it's not unique and can absolutely be solved.
Well, we can continue the conversation. If you're interested in continuing that with you, Dan, you can find her on LinkedIn and also her website, udanshee.com. And we love continuing conversations here on Taking Care of Business. I look forward to our next encounter, you, Dan. Thanks again.
Thank you, Jackie, for having me.
Thank you. You're listening to Taking Care of Business, as we like sharing the knowledge and talking about lots of really key issues in business. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Taking Care of Business. Now, this is a topic that is really hot at the moment, and it's all about resilience, stress, pressure management. Our next guest knows all about high pressure situations. He works with entrepreneurs and SMEs, and we all know those that do run their own business. There may be short bursts of stress or long standing situations that require patience and resilience to get through and rise up. He has also worked with big corporates like Coles Myer, Toyota, St George, and the Victorian Parliament. I think politicians at the moment certainly need his help. I'd like to welcome to the show Michael Lichenblatt.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Really great to have you here, Michael. Now, when you're doing corporate work, is there much difference between the corporate work and the work you do with entrepreneurs or SMEs?
Look, it's different type of pressure, but the response to pressure is consistent. What we're seeing now is that the people want more in less time. They have fewer resources, so they're being squeezed a lot more for their resources, for their ability to apply themselves under pressure. From a corporate point of view, we're looking at a lot more stakeholders influencing decisions. From an entrepreneurial point of view, business owners are touching more things. They are being more things in their business. So they're spread a lot more thin and they're feeling the impact of pressure in that way.
Okay, so I thought it might be a good place to start talking about some definitions, because it got me thinking, and some of our listeners might be thinking the same thing, what's the difference between stress and pressure and resilience? So those three, how do they all sort of fit in together?
Certainly. Stress is the byproduct when pressure is not managed well. It's sort of like the blood that comes out when I cut myself is the stress. The cut itself is the result of bad pressure management. You can use that comparison. Resilience is the way in which I handle pressure, not so much that I just cope and get through better, but rather how I am a better version of myself. The traditional approach to pressure is being, how much can I take? How much can I tolerate? And it's seen as an ability to sort of just toughen up and get through. And don't mistake me, there's great value in doing that. However, in modern day resilience, it's not just how well you can cope and how many things you can take on, but how well you can actually be, or how well you can actually apply yourself and be the best version of yourself to actually thrive and be as dollar productive as you can in high pressure, but without burning yourself out, without actually having a fallout or a cost in some part of your world, personally or professionally.
Yeah, oh, that's a great explanation, because I was thinking about that. I was thinking pressure, stress, but you're also dealing with things like setbacks and rejections, and that's something entrepreneurs really have to learn how to manage. Is that your experience?
Oh, absolutely. Look, with the amount of setbacks and pressures or rejection that we deal with nowadays is exponential compared to what it was even sort of 10 or so years ago. Markets are more competitive, budgets are tighter, and we are doing more with less time, which simply means that I'm going to face more roadblocks. So there are more people competing for the same, so I've got to work harder and deal with more rejections and setbacks. You'll find this across every industry, from professional services to real estate, through sales, a whole range of industries, which simply means this, that business owners or people in corporate world need to understand how they can take a setback, not be bogged down by it, not be stopped, not be slowed down, but to bounce back faster so that they don't lose a beat when things don't go well, or they've put a lot of work into a client or a sale and it falls over at the end, and that may then affect their cash flow and their budget. How do they stay focused? Because one of the core things in business is that your energy now is your currency. So you've got to be able to invest that wisely. So your ability to be resilient and bounce back has direct impact on your bottom line.
Yeah, and it's not a matter of if, it's when, as far as rejection, setbacks, when you are running your own business. And I get a bit upset about this distorted focus on follow your passion, you know, rainbows and unicorns, and there's not enough talk about, okay, so what do you do when you have a bad day? What happens when you spend hours and days on a proposal or you're pitching for business and you lose it or you don't even hear back from them? People don't even give you the courtesy of letting you know, all these sort of setbacks, and then it can really be very demoralizing and can affect your confidence. It can affect so many areas, and of course that then bleeds into your personal life, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And when you say when a person's in a business or area where, because they're passionate about it, they're putting heart and soul into what they do. And in many ways you're working harder than a lot of other people because you're so committed, both personally and you have skin in the game financially as well. So when you've put that work into a proposal or into building up a bunch of relationships with possible prospects and clients, and then they all fall over, or a series of them fall over, and you see the fallout that comes from that, both financially and personally, you start thinking, what's wrong with me? The questions we're asking are the wrong questions. You're saying, well, what's wrong with me? What am I doing wrong? You know, why is this happening to me? But the reality is, this is just part and parcel with business. And when you're passionately involved, the rejection feels more personal. Now, that's not to say don't be passionately involved. You want to put your heart into what you do. But we want to understand also that that is going to mean that the rejection is going to hurt harder or hurt more because you are taking things to heart. And one of the great importance of resilience is to be lighter and to bounce back so that, you know, expect the rejection but be able to recover from it faster.
Yeah, and I know that you've got lots of answers of how we can do that, and you'll be sharing these fascinating and useful and practical insights at the upcoming BITE conference, Business, Innovation, Technology and Entrepreneurialism, which I'll be joining you there, Michael. I'm looking forward to it very much. And so what will you be actually talking about at BITE for those that will come and have a look and listen to what you've got to say?
So we're looking at a couple of things. The first, we need to understand the changing landscape of business. You see, if we're busy just working harder and we're not really adapting to the changing landscape of pressure, all we're doing is chasing our tails, which means that people in business are doing, but not getting any progress. So we're going to talk about how to understand what's happening around them. We're also going to provide with a couple of skills and insights around what it means to be resilient and how you specifically build those strengths and how that translates to business bottom line. It's not just these touchy-feely skills, these soft skills that feel nice, but they translate to business outcome. And I want to link the behavior change to a take-home ability to be able to perform better and be more personally productive and profitable within your business. And we'll also look at the aspect of adaptability and resilience, and that it's a combination of skills. It's not just simply working harder and being stronger and having a tougher shield, but there are ways that allow you to perform at your best. So this is really the psychology of implementation and what it takes to be able to bounce back and how you share that with your team. So there'll be a whole bunch of things we'll talk about.
I love a segue, Michael, and thank you for leading me to one, because your background is actually in psychology. But I also noticed, and I've never come across anyone with a more unique background, that you've combined that with shiatsu therapy and martial arts. Martial arts and psychology, where do we start?
Well, it's an interest. It is probably just one of the most unique backgrounds when it comes to resilience and in a business context. I guess that what it allows me to do is that the martial arts gives me an understanding of how to read patterns in people and how to perform in high-pressure environments, because nothing says focus when someone's trying to hit you and hurt you. So there's a great learning that comes from staying calm under pressure. And for me, the psychology is about understanding behavior, that what you see is not always what you get. So often if you can understand what motivates us and how we get things done or what we do to avoid activation and avoid implementation, this is key to resilience. And the shiatsu really, it looks at the way people process pressure. And if you can understand the way you process pressure mentally and even physically, however you hold it, and if you can flip that and you know what switches to flip, you go from coasting or just getting through your day and dealing with stress to being high performance and bouncing back. There's a very distinct transition between those two. And I find that these behavioral changes is what allows people to build that resilience deliberately rather than just endure, and then burn out in the process.
Yeah, I always find that the most beneficial and useful consultants and speakers are those that have had an interesting eclectic background. You know, you've got lots of zigs and zags there, because it's about cross-fertilising that information. I find most people that have sort of stayed in their one lane the whole time can get very one-dimensional in their thinking, particularly if they are a thought leader, which you know, and you're speaking and educating, which you do. I think that's great that you can actually use that for cross-fertilising. But I was thinking about psychology and martial arts and resilience, and it's almost the perfect recipe, because it's about self-defence. It's about coping and motivation. And you mentioned the word earlier, which is about bounce back. And I think if I put all that in a pot, Michael, and I had to get the jus of you, I think it is about bounce back. I think that's really a real key. to it.
And that would be absolutely cool, not just to myself, but also to the message and how you apply that message. As you draw the analogy to the martial arts, it's actually been said that real learning in martial arts only occurs when you get your black belt. That's sort of where the true learning starts. Everything up to that is your preparation, which simply means that in life, you've got to go through stuff first sometimes before your ears are ready to listen. And I find then working with people in business who have some skin in the game, they're not just green to the whole thing. They've turned up with this wonderful passion and ideal they've gone for, but people who have put in the hard yards. But they understand that business can be tough. They're more ready to listen. And I find taking practical approaches, not just wonderful theoretical stuff, but stuff which I've lived myself. I've been driving business now for 30 years, lived through ups and downs. And I'm a dad of three kids, so I get the fact how it can be hard to balance work and life at times. And the whole concept of work-life balance is this lovely term that doesn't really exist. And the whole concept of resilience is not about perfection or being bulletproof, but rather your intrinsic and deliberate ability to have a special relationship with pressure that allows you to be the best version of yourself.
What a lovely way to finish off. Michael Leitenblatt, thank you so much for your precious time. Our ears and eyes will be ready to listen to your pearls of wisdom at the Bike Conference. I really appreciate your time today and look forward to seeing you there.
Absolute pleasure, and thank you very much for the interview.
Loved it, love it. We love stress, managing stress, managing pressure, managing resilience. We are going to bounce back here on Taking Care of Business right after this short break. That's the end of another stimulating show. We hope you've enjoyed eavesdropping on our conversation, picked up some tips, learned something new, or at the very least feel inspired. If you just joined us, you missed a lot. The podcast will be on the website, rwpfm.com.au, and you can connect with me to continue the conversation, Jackie Mitchell, on social media or at brandstorm.com.au. Thank you today to our worldly and thought-provoking guests. We look forward to your company next Friday. At 11 a.m. In the meantime, keep taking care of your business.
Yay!
Oh, thank you.